This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
So it is truly my pleasure to introduce Professor Jeffrey Sachs, one of the most influential international economists and public intellectuals of our time. He is known both for his early work restructuring national economies and his current efforts as a champion of global poverty reduction. A tenured full professor at Harvard, before turning 30, he was part of a small group of young intellectual economists called upon by troubled governments to advise them on what were then some of the world's most daunting economic challenges. In the mid-1980s, Bolivia, plagued by hyperinflation, was on the verge of economic collapse and financial default. A few years later, Poland and Russia and other East European countries were transitioning from state communism to market economies. Jeff and his colleagues called for strong, decisive solutions, including the release of price and currency controls, along with economic privatization and a vastly reduced role for government. This approach came to be known as shock therapy. Yet Jeff had also called for measures to ease the shock part of the treatment, including forgiving past loans and providing foreign financial assistance. While the shock part was often followed, the therapy part was often ignored. And as he recounts in his writings, the lessons he learned from these efforts led him to an appreciation of the limits of purely market-based solutions and the role that governments should play. Today, he is one of a handful of leading economists who challenge the orthodoxy of what is called market fundamentalism. Jeff Sachs has become a powerful voice for policies that would pull countries out of the poverty trap that condemns a billion people to lives of starvation, disease, and early death. He advises the world's leading international organizations on these issues, including the United Nations, where under former Secretary General Kofi Annan, he was advisor on the Millennium Development Goals, the internationally agreed upon measures to significantly reduce extreme poverty, disease, and hunger by the year 2015. Jeff is professor of sustainable development as well as health policy and management at Columbia University, where he heads the Earth Institute. He is president and co-founder of the Millennium Promise Alliance, a nonprofit aimed at ending extreme global poverty. He is regularly ranked by Time magazine as one of the world's most influential people. And among his many, many awards and honors, last year he received India's Padma Bhushan, that country's third highest civilian honor. In his Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet, Jeff paints a comprehensive picture of the major challenges facing humanity today, challenges which he argues portend catastrophe unless we put our heads together and address them and do so quickly. As you will hear momentarily, the cost of meeting these global challenges is not great, not in a world where 2 days of Pentagon spending would wipe out malaria in Africa. Let us hope that the world leaders wake up to his call. Let's give a warm Santa Barbara welcome to Professor Jeff Sachs.
Amazing. That is a wonderful welcome, and what an incredible turnout, and what a wonderful place. Richard, thank you so much, and thank you, Santa Barbara, for having me here today. And I'm very much looking forward to sharing the stage this evening with Greg Mortensen and learning more about his wonderful and truly amazing work. So it's going to be, I think, a wonderful evening for all of us to be engaged in what Richard said, putting our heads together to solve some of the problems that are obviously not only confronting us, but growing on this planet. We have some daunting challenges, and indeed, I think it's a real sense that we have these days that problems do often seem to be spinning out of control. And crises are coming at us often so fast and furious that it's Darfur 1 week, and then suddenly a food crisis we didn't even know about, which becomes the headlines and riots around the world. And then that's overtaken by Hurricane Nargis and 100,000 people dying because of another extreme climate shock, almost unimaginable. And then an earthquake with vulnerable people and 10,000 dead. The world seems to be overwhelmed, not to mention the ongoing wars, the spreading violence, the lack of solution. And I think for many reasons, there is a great deal of pessimism and a great deal of fear. And I think we need to do a great deal of change if we're going to confront these challenges, because the sad part is that if we continue doing what we're doing in this country with the kinds of disastrous policies that we've had for the last 8 years and the not-so-good policies that actually preceded it, let's be nonpartisan for a moment, though this administration does stand out with special accolades for mismanagement, no doubt about it. It is the worst, we've not done so well in global problem solving for a while, and these problems have come upon us not in an utterly predictable way, but what I think is predictable is that if we leave crucial problems unsolved, we will continue to be surprised by the ricochet events in the way that we're seeing them now. I hope in a few minutes I can share with you my understanding of the kind of situation we face in the world, why I think our generation has a unique challenge and a unique opportunity, why we are on a wrong course, and what kind of course could be an appropriate path given the challenges that we face. In my book, Commonwealth, I summarize this also in my own mind, essentially with one word. It's called Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet. And I would put the stress on crowded for a moment. It's crowded in many senses, literal and metaphorical. In a literal sense, there are 6.7 billion people on the planet, of course, more than at any time in history. But not just that, we've gone through two centuries of a tenfold increase of population. From the time that our modern economic era started, the industrial age, about 200 years ago till today, the population has roughly increased 10 times. We've not adjusted to that fact, to the fact that we have really filled every ecological niche on the planet, and we're in each other's faces as never before. And by the way, the population continues to grow, as I'll emphasize in just a few minutes, by about 75 million people net every year. That's not a small number, actually, and it's something that we have to account for. There's another sense in which we're crowded, and that is our ability to fill the world with human-made economic activity. This has increased even faster than our sheer numbers. Economists have a way of measuring the output produced by an economy or by the world, for that matter, in a given year. We call it a gross national product or a gross world product. And there are ways to adjust the very different prices and currencies around the world to come up with a common standard of measure, what we call purchasing power adjusted income. And by that measure, the average level of output in the world today is about $10,000 per person. And that averages the high income countries like the United States, Europe, Japan, Singapore, Israel, and a few others, as well as the impoverished countries that Greg is going to talk about and I'll speak about as well. at the low end, which by these standards might be about $1,000 per person, when adjusted for price levels, or in the way we would often talk about it, unadjusted, maybe $200 or $300 per person per year. Now, sticking with the average of $10,000 for 6.7 billion people, that means that our level of economic activity is $67 trillion per year worldwide, roroughly $70 trillion. We never saw anything like this before. The capacity of human beings using a great deal of science and technology and ingenuity, after all, to be able to mass produce so much, move so many resources, indeed feed most of the 6.7 billion, not all by any means adequately, and create a level of well-being for large parts of the world, even those parts we call the developing world, unimaginable just a few decades, even in some cases just a few years before. But that $70 trillion is awfully crowded on the planet. It means an interconnected global economy where production systems, technology, the flow of goods, services, finance, ideas is connecting all parts of the world. All this discussion about whether we're in favor of trade or not in favor, by the way, this is campaign talk, because we're in a world economy. We're in a global production system. The only way we get out of that is disaster. There's no sound, smart way out of that. We're already interconnected in our needs, in what feeds us, in our modes of economic production. And it's going to become more so, again, short of disaster, which, of course, is our ultimate point to avoid. I don't think we've adjusted very well to this level of economic activity and population, because if the population has gone up tenfold, the level of economic output per person has increased perhaps 20-fold from the start of the industrial era. It's not even an exactly sensible comparison, because we do things that weren't even done before, but on rough standard, perhaps 20 times. And so maybe we've had a 200-fold increase of human economic activity and throughput, and with huge implications for the planet. In fact, we've arrived at such a stunning level of economic activity and with certain characteristics now that we are at profound risk, and that's what I'd like to describe. We also are at a moment of profound opportunity as well. That's the paradox of our time. On the opportunity side, before we get to the risks, what's happening in the global economy in many ways is dramatically heartening, and that is that we've arrived at $10,000 per person because in this interconnected global economy, the chances for the poorer countries on average to be able to benefit from the technological advances in the world are greater than ever. And this has given the potential for very poor places to narrow the income gaps with the richer countries, not by dragging us down, but by pulling up formerly desperately poor parts of the world by raising their productivity and thereby increasing their living standards. This is a process that economists call convergence. And convergence has been taking hold and actually intensifying since the Second World War. It didn't operate during the imperial era because imperial powers didn't give space for that kind of catching up to the countries under their control. And because the conditions, the spread of technology, transport, communications, and so forth, weren't as favorable as they are now. But in today's world of sovereign nations, open borders if we have them, and peace, the chance for technologies to spread to all parts of the world and to benefit all parts of the world are astoundingly strong, even in the poorest places in the world in many cases. In Africa, where I just returned a few days ago from a trip to some of the poorest regions of Africa, cell phone coverage is now about 200 million subscribers on a market basis. Now, at the same time, there are people that don't have enough food to stay alive, so it's a complicated picture. But technologies are diffusing at an astounding rate. This has allowed a place like China, although there is no place like China other than China. So let me just say, this has allowed China, a civilization unto itself, 1.3 billion people, 22% of the world's population, to experience 10% per year economic growth for 30 years. Now, what does that mean? If you put money in the bank and it grows at 10%, it will double in 7 years. If an economy is growing at 10% per year, it doubles in size in 7 years. If you do that 30 years running, that's four doublings. That means 2 times 2 times 2 times 2. That means that China's economy has had a 16-fold increase for 1.3 billion people since Deng Xiaoping declared that to be rich is glorious and opened the economy after Mao's death. This is a defining moment in the world. It means a lot of things. One thing it does mean for us is that the center of gravity in the world is shifting from where it has been for at least the last two centuries, the North Atlantic, to the Pacific Basin, enjoy it, Santa Barbara, and to Asia, which has more than half of the world's population, so it's not surprising that it will have more than half of the world's production and output in the course of the 21st century as this kind of convergence continues. India, of course, it's not growing at quite the pace, and it's just a little baby. It's only 1.1 billion people, not 1.3 billion people. But it's growing at about 7% per year, which is a doubling time of 10 years. And that's been going on now for nearly 20 years. And so that's a fourfold increase with a lot more to come. So that big $70 trillion economy that I mentioned, the good news is that there is not what's sometimes stereotyped as the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, nor is it true that the poor are getting richer and the rich are getting poorer, which is how our election rhetoric sometimes makes it sound, because we have gotten richer in real terms in this country, actually quite considerably so over the last 30 years. What's happened on average is actually a bit better, which is that the rich have been getting richer, and the poor, on average, have been getting richer as well, and even faster than the rich, so that the gap has been narrowing. And that's how we got to $70 trillion. And indeed, the growth of the world economy has been so fast that on average, taking the modest step-by-step growth of the technology leaders like the United States and the galloping growth of the technology followers who are able to grab those technologies that they never had before and catapult themselves up to a higher level of productivity, has meant an average growth in the world economy of 5% per year. That, ladies and gentlemen, is a doubling time of 14 years, which means if we continued at 5% per year, our $70 trillion world economy in the year 2022 would be a $140 trillion economy, if that could just continue. Now, that all sounds okay. Just a couple of problems. One is, it can't continue that way. at least not with the technologies we have, because we're going to break the planet before we succeed in carrying on this kind of growth for much longer. And we're already seeing some profound strains just now. The $126 barrel in oil, though I didn't check the ticker before today or as of today's closing, and the tripling of food prices in international markets in the last year is a sign and a harbinger of risks of how we're pushing against certain limits right now that mean that a simple extrapolation is not possible. There's another blemish in this story. Averages are not very convincing for people that are not, and nobody is average, mind you, but for people that are not at $10,000 but at the bottom end, it's all fine and good to talk about a growing economy, but let's keep in mind, actually even try to get into mind, the basic truth that 10 million children died last year of being too poor to stay alive. So to put poverty in its terms, I think we need to count it not a dollar a day or other measures that are used. Let's say for what it is, millions of deaths as a result of the fact that people cannot meet the most basic needs of safe water, adequate food, access to basic preventative and curative health care in significant parts of the world. Not as much of the world as before. One out of six that are trapped right now in extreme poverty and are not beneficiaries of this overall convergence process, and indeed are often profound losers from it, because while that growth is going forward without them, other global shocks, not only brain drain from those places, but the climate change coming into those places, is making it hard for them even to keep the fragile foothold on survival that they have right now. So if you step back and say, what's wrong with this picture of the planet that we're living on? It is the following. We're an interconnected world that first doesn't accept that basic point because our mindset has not kept pace with the reality in which we're living, and our political institutions even less. The last place to ask is Washington. Second, while there is a lot of economic development taking place, there are parts of the world that are trapped in the most extreme duress. Duress so severe, it's hard for us to imagine. And I'm sure that Greg is going to show us some amazing pictures of his work and places that are in that kind of poverty trap. A trap that can be unsprung by the kind of work that Greg is doing and by investments that we can be making to help unspring or spring these people from a trap that they're now facing. Very often, geography, by the way, is one of the definers of this. Landlocked countries like Afghanistan, mountainous environments, extreme drylands often define the vulnerabilities that are the predicate of a trap of poverty. They're not deterministic. There are ways out, but they are conditioning factors which make it harder for growth to come to some places than to others. Being on the coast, and such a beautiful coast you have, being near a port, being in international shipping lanes, having productive agriculture, being at sea level, those kinds of advantages are quite important in economic geography compared to being in the mountains, being in the drylands, being in the highlands, being in the landlocked regions. And then comes perhaps even a harder challenge. And that is unlocking the poor from poverty is the most urgent of our challenges without question, because that's life and death. Life and death for millions of people every year. And the difference of the struggle over life and death for hundreds of millions on the planet. But the economic growth now has also reached an almost existential crisis for the planet as well. We have not adjusted to the reality of a $70 trillion world economy, much less one that continues to have underlying tremendous dynamism for even greater economic throughput in the future, especially as India and China and Brazil and other currently low-income countries increase their economic output. What's happened is that our skill, our technology has become so vast that we have overtaken many of the most crucial of the Earth's physical systems, and we've hardly recognized it. And we're doing things on the planet that we don't even know that could be of profound risk to us. We know some of them, but I'm sure we don't know others. We didn't know until it was almost too late that we were destroying the ozone level, stratospheric ozone, because the chemicals that were doing it, the chlorofluorocarbons, were deemed by almost all chemists to be inert, safe refrigerants and aerosols, and it was only the brilliant work of three scientists that uncovered how these CFCs would interact in the stratosphere to deplete the ozone level. It was almost an accidental discovery. It wasn't a hunt to solve a puzzle. It was an accidental realization that we were at risk, and then a NASA satellite photo which proved it. We were extraordinarily lucky. What we can be sure is that we're posing pressures on the planet now of absolutely unprecedented magnitude, and we've not adjusted our social and technological and economic systems to understand how to handle this. One of these scientists that contributed to the discovery of the ozone depletion, Paul Crutzen, has coined a phrase which I believe we all ought to use to understand this, a very incisive way of describing it. And that is, if you live around geologists like I do, they talk about us having moved from the Pleistocene, the Ice Age, to the Holocene, which is the post-Ice Age era of the last 10,000 years, the era of agriculture and all the rest of human history, recent history. But Crutzen says, no, we've moved from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. And by Anthropocene, he means the geologic age dominated by man, Anthropos. So we're now living at a time when the Earth's physical systems are actually under the forcing, as they call it, of our human activities. We know it because we've learned about it with respect to greenhouse gases and especially carbon dioxide emissions, which is about 3/4 of the radiative forcing of the greenhouse gases. Burning fossil fuel and deforesting, now in the tropics, emitting 36 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the air, means that human beings are now raising the carbon concentration, and we've done that 1/3 relative to the pre-industrial level. And we're on a path now of accelerating increase of carbon dioxide concentrations such that if we just continued what we're doing at the current arithmetic rate of raising carbon concentrations 2.4 parts per million, by the end of this century, we would have doubled the pre-industrial concentration of carbon dioxide, and virtually all science tells us now this would be profoundly threatening to millions of species and to our own well-being, if not survival. But because we're not just progressing at the same rate now, we're accelerating because of this economic growth, we'll reach that level in 30 or 40 years on our current trajectory. And, by the way, we just wasted 8 years doing zero about it. It's not only climate change, it's wherever you look. It's habitat destruction, because we're now using about half of the photosynthesis potential of our planet for our species, thank you, and we are pushing the rest of the species right off the planet because we are appropriating our food and our fiber and our wood products and our other needs for us. 6.7 billion people, $70 trillion economy, soon to be $140 trillion economy. We want more stuff. We've taken over the nitrogen cycle because to feed 6.7 billion people requires a lot of nitrogen input. And that comes from nitrogen-based fertilizers. Organic farming could not do it. To keep people alive, we need chemical fertilizers. We now place more nitrogen into the soil than nitrogen fixing bacteria, lightning, and other physical processes. And this, of course, is having huge effects on the safety of the water supply, on our estuaries, where there are 30 dead zones around the world that come from the eutrophication processes. The nitrogen gets concentrated by the rivers and then into the discharge into the seas, as in the Gulf of Mexico. We've taken over the hydrological cycle, the water cycle. There are 60,000 dams on the planet now. California depends on this. Every river that flows is dammed, and even those that don't flow anymore. And many big rivers don't reach the ocean anymore, of course, all over the world. The Yellow River, the Ganges, and many, many others. We couldn't double the amount of water diversion anymore on the planet because it's not available anymore. There are other things we can do, harvesting rainwater more effectively, but these days, if you build a dam, in most parts of the world, it's a zero-sum struggle between upstream and downstream now. Who gets it? Not simply utilization, but actually one versus the other. We have rearranged the biogeography on the planet with invasive species. And of course, all of this has put millions of species at risk of survival, amphibian populations, pollinator populations, being decimated now, fisheries around the world being overfished in virtually all parts of the world. So here we are. We've discovered wonderful things that can extend life expectancy. I think most of us like the way we live, and we'd like it to be sustainable. I'm a big fan, by the way, of electricity, because I work in places without it, and I see how children die when there's no electricity, or I see how there's no safe water when there's no pump, or I see how mothers spend 8 hours a day collecting water, fetching 20-kilogram, 44-pound jugs of water, walking hours every day because there's no pump and electricity. I'm a big fan of economic development. I don't regard it as frivolous. I like chemical fertilizer, by the way, because I know in the oxisol tropical soils that we're working in, that when you add a bag of urea, the crop triples, the children stay alive, and the family has an income. Those are all good things. I believe people should I believe that their aspirations for economic improvement are legitimate, and I would like to see that happen and succeed. And so I view the problem that we're facing as not a problem of our immorality, because I don't think that's the issue. I don't think using fossil fuel is immoral, by the way. I think it has the unfortunate side effect that carbon dioxide happens to be a greenhouse gas that, because of quantum mechanics, captures infrared radiation. But I don't view that as a moral issue. I view it as bad luck, in a way. But I do view it as something that we have to do something about. So my view is that our generation's challenge is sustainable development, with an equal emphasis on both words. Development, meaning economic improvement, rising material well-being, extension of electricity and roads and cars and transport, I view as an understandable and good thing, especially in the poor parts of the world, and something that's important to happen. At the other hand, the physical reality of a crowded planet says that we literally cannot sustain what we're doing. We can't even stay in the same place, much less meet the aspirations of material improvement with our current technologies. We need to find a new course, quite a different course. And I'm so happy President Bush has been talking about this for the last 8 years. I can assure you there's not anything that our army in Iraq can do about any of this, not only to solve any problems in Iraq, but to solve any of the big problems in the world. And I can assure you that Senator McCain has it absolutely wrong when he says that the transcendent challenge of our time is Islamic extremism. I've yet to meet a place sitting around hating us for our freedom. People are not sitting around, they're wondering where their water's going to come from, where their next meal's going to come from, whether their children can be in school, like the schools that Greg Mortensen is building, whether they can get health care if a mosquito transmits a bite of malaria, or whether a million children will continue to die for a disease that is 100% treatable for an 80-cent dose of medicine. We have to face up to the real challenge that in an interconnected world, we have to make this world work in an interconnected way. And that means able to recognize and support the aspirations of all parts of the world for prosperity to stay alive, for a chance at betterment, and to do it in a way which just observes the physical arithmetic of our planet, the capacity of the air, the oceans, the land, to support us and other species. This would be a pretty dismal place to stop this kind of, or to end, and my time's up. And so let me tell you quickly, it isn't a dismal picture for the following reason. All that prowess which has brought us the ability to feed 6.7 billion people, or at least, let's say, 5.8 billion people, and the others struggle for the food they need. And all that prowess which has brought us to a $70 trillion world economy is also available for us finding a pathway to sustainable development. Yeah. Yeah. And I believe that's not just empty rhetoric or empty hope, but actually pretty darn practical. Yes. All right. What I know to be the case in the places that my colleagues and I are working in the poorest parts of the world, whether it's in Cambodia or whether it's in sub-Saharan Africa or whether it's in Haiti or whether it's in Guatemala and elsewhere, is that we already have the technologies at hand so that nobody in this world has to die of their poverty, not even close. And there is a pathway at low cost that can help people trapped in poverty get out of poverty. And it essentially means investing in their future with improved technologies for food production, with bringing to bear the wonders of modern public health and medicine, with ensuring that all children can go to school, have a midday meal when they're there so that they can learn and absorb properly, and have the basic infrastructure that is needed, the roads, the power, yes, the internet, the cell phone connectivity that's a vital part of being a part of a planetary interconnected economy. And it turns out this is just tens of dollars to ensure this for everybody on the planet. Too much for people that have nothing, but almost nothing for people that have something. I was going to give you one health example, if I might. Richard already alluded to it. But let me just do one bit of arithmetic for you before I finish up. Malaria will kill, as I said, 1, even 2 million children this year. It is largely preventable by an insecticide-treated bed net. Okay? It's 100% treatable if you get the infection, despite having a bed net, by a medicine, artemisinin and combination therapy, 80-cent dose for 3 days for a child. There are about 600 million people in Africa that live in the malaria transmission zones, and there are 300 million bed nets, approximately, that are needed. On average, it's 300 million sleeping sites in the malaria transmission zones. Everyone should be protected. These bed nets are now engineered so that they cost $5 per bed net to last 5 years. My PhD has come in handy here. Multiplication. 5 times 300 million, $1.5 billion cost for 5 years coverage. We are now spending every day on the Pentagon, $1.9 billion. 1 day's Pentagon coverage, 1 day, would provide anti-malaria bed nets for all of Africa for 5 years. So my specific policy recommendation is the Pentagon take next Thursday off. All right. If you turn to the environmental side very briefly, and I'd love to be, maybe we'll, in discussion we can come back, just to say, in some cases the technologies already exist. Why is President Bush in Congress saying our mileage standard will be 35 miles per gallon by the year 2020, when we've got 50 mile per gallon cars now? This is what's wrong. But there are many transformative technologies that are close to being brought to bear on a large scale. The solar thermal in the Mojave Desert, which could provide electricity more than half of America's needs without any emissions at all, for example, that with a bit more investment in science and technology can be brought to bear on a huge scale. We've lost the time, but we've not let lost at all. We wasted 8 years, but we can still get started. Let me end, if I could, with a few quick suggestions for the next president. Why not? Here's my memo for January 21st, 2009. Presumably there will have been a nice ball the night before, and now it's time to get down to work. 10 quick points. 1, end the Iraq war now. 2. Senator McCain did not slip when he said 100 years. That's the plan, actually. Not of war for 100 years, but of a base for 100 years. That's what we call energy security. And it's guaranteed energy insecurity. We don't need bases in the Middle East for our oil, for our energy security. We need a sound foreign policy and energy alternatives for our energy security. 3. So that's already, let's put aside $200 billion a year saving. Thank you. 2, like it or not, we're going to end the Bush tax cuts. We've got to. 4. That's another $250 billion that we're going to need, because we got other stuff we got to do in this world. Partly stop the fiscal bleeding already, and partly solve some problems. The 3rd is we got to start investing like we actually mean it to save the planet. We've been spending $3 billion a year in our total effort to develop sustainable energy technologies. That is a day and a half of Pentagon spending. We spend $1 trillion for our, quote, energy security, but we don't muster more than a day and a half of Pentagon spending to actually invest in solar or long mileage automobiles or second generation biofuels, which should be the only generation biofuels, because it doesn't make sense to put food in our gas tank. So I think we need a National Institutes of Sustainable Technology, like we have a National Institutes of Health. And we ought to fund it the same way, at the same scale, about $30 billion a year. Then we'd be able to move to dramatic reductions of carbon emissions, 100 mile per gallon automobiles, plug-in hybrids, many other solutions that are at hand. 4th recommendation is immediately send around a climate envoy to the capitals of the world to let them know we're back at the negotiating table. We have a treaty to finish under the Bali Plan of Action in Copenhagen by the end of 2009. I hope the next president's prepared even before January 21, but we're going to have to move fast, and the world is waiting for us, not to lead, by the way, just to partner, because that's what we need to do. The 5th point is we need to come into compliance with international law for the rest of our global commons to sign the Convention on Biological Diversity. Can you imagine we have not ratified the treaty to protect biodiversity in the planet? We signed it, but we didn't ratify it. To sign the law of the sea. And while we're at it, to remember that under the Constitution, these international treaties, when they are signed and ratified, are national law. So, just as a parenthesis, it is illegal to torture because the Geneva Conventions count. The 6th point is that I think we ought to quickly send around an invitation. We ought to send around an invitation to the president of Senegal, Mali, Chad, Sudan, Ethiopia, Somalia, J- Djibouti, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Phoenix, Arizona, Southern California, Atlanta, Australia, and other drylands of the world. For a drylands initiative, which says that our transcendent problem is not Islamic or any other kind of extremism, it's water and food. And that we will work together with places under the most stress in the world to help them solve their problems. We got the problems together. We got one global food market. We've got food in short supply. We've got water stress in all parts of the world, rich and poor, and we can work together to do it. And seven, while we're at it, let's stop putting our food into the gas tank immediately. It was never, by the way, a very smart idea, but now it's really a dumb idea, and it needs to be ended. And it's costing us billions of dollars for a wrong-headed policy. Eight, we ought to take seriously, again, the fact that 75, 80 million people net population increase each year is not sustainable either. It's time to help places with fertility rates of 6 or 7 or 8, have the girls stay in school, have the children survive so the parents are confident about reducing fertility, have family planning available, contraception, things we stopped talking about in this country, so that it would be possible, especially in light of the fact that the next 2.5 billion people, according to the UN medium fertility population forecast, are all coming in the poorest parts of the world, to help these places for their own sake and for the globe's sake to reduce voluntarily their fertility rates to manageable levels. And this can be accomplished. There's enormous evidence for it. We have to stop canceling our contribution to the UN Population Fund and start championing it again. And the last and most important point that I would raise is the need for the United States to get back on the side of the world in solving these problems, especially the poorest of the poor. We are, in our name, ladies and gentlemen, all signed up to the Millennium Development Goals, but you'd hardly know it. You might not even know what they are, given the fact that the President of the United States, to my knowledge, has said those three words consecutively one time in the last 8 years, Millennium Development Goals. The world has shared objectives to fight extreme poverty, hunger, and disease. We set a timetable starting in the year 2000 to be completed by the year 2015. President Bush has not told us much about that. I happened to be at the United Nations the one time, one day, September 14, 2005, 10:14 a.m., when he said, America's committed to the Millennium Development Goals. Never heard it before and haven't heard it since. And the world's wondering where we are. We promised, like the rest of the high-income world, to devote, it's not very much, but we said 70 cents out of every $100 of our income. You think we could manage that? 70 cents? We'll keep $99.30 for us and 70 cents for the world's poorest people so that they can stay alive and become healthy and constructive part of a world society. I think we could manage that. But what are we managing? Well, we're managing not 70 cents, we're managing basically about $5 right now for the military per 100. But when it comes to aid, we're managing 16 cents out of $100, the lowest level of all of the high-income countries in the world, the lowest ratio. And when you take out the part that's going to Afghanistan and Iraq and others in the war zone, often in shoeboxes of money for Halliburton and for Blackwater and others, and instead ask what's going for the truly poorest people, yes, in those places and in sub-Saharan Africa, in total in sub-Saharan Africa, our aid out of $100, 3.5 cents. Then, by the way, after giving almost nothing, then we blame Africa for having squandered the aid that we didn't give them, which is a little bit nervy on our part. So we promised that we'd manage that 70 cents, and the rest of the world did. And if we live up to it, we're going to find that extreme poverty can be ended, and not only to the benefit of saving millions of lives, but to the benefit of not facing a world where we face one shocking threat 1 week after the next, but rather where we have a world that is interconnected and secure because of that, and where enemies today, who might even seem irreconcilable enemies, become partners in a common cause. I want to see, in this last point, I'd like to see the Millennium Development Goals in the inaugural address of the next President of the United States. I'm often told, can't be done, won't be done, can't cooperate. I don't believe it. I think we can help make this happen, each of us. We can demand it of our politicians, and we can demand it of ourselves. And I often think and refer to what I regard as the most inspiring moment of bold leadership in modern American history, when President John Kennedy, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, helped us to find a way not only back from the brink of nuclear annihilation, but actually to the first treaty with the Soviet Union in 1963, the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, because he told the American people, we can cooperate, even with the Russian people, even with the Soviet Union, because we have common interests. They're people. They also have common interests. And he put it this way, and I'd like to close here, in his speech at American University in June 1963, which I regard as the greatest speech of a modern American president. He said, "So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and to the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's future. And we are all mortal." Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.